Thanks, Mark. Who was in the general session this morning? That's really good, because that was like half my talk, I think. Was already covered really well this morning. I think a lot of the key points, the background about genomics, the kind of the history, how we got to where we are, I thought was really well done. So kind of what I prepared today is actually kind of diving, just kind of getting right into the meat of it, really. We're moving over to the single-step evaluation, and there's differences. I think Mark used the term major. I haven't used that term in the presentation, but you're probably not too far off. For those of you who don't know me, I've been at Angus since September, and I can say this is the biggest thing that's happened to the Angus genetic evaluation since I've been there. Absolutely. 100%. This is a slide I used to have, and I didn't have a date in there, but now there's a date. People have been asking the question for a long time, actually since I've came, you know, when's single step going to be out? And there's been a lot of anticipation, so we've got a date on the calendar now to deliver on the 7th of July. And that is the day where twice a year we do a SIRE summary that gets published, and you might have be familiar with it, that's printed, and that's the date that's actually run for that printed copy. So that'll be technically the fall of 2017 evaluation, but it's run on that Friday, the 7th of July. But single step has been in development for a lot longer than that, and the question you might have is, well, why 7th of July, why not last November? And the truth be told, there's been a lot of work on it in between those times. So what are we going to look at today? I've actually got... Didn't actually change. So when I talk about production, that's what runs every week. So at Angus, we've got a weekly cattle evaluation, and right now we run this two-step process, and that happens every week, and new results go out every Friday. That's what we call production. And how are what we're going to see come July with single step, how is it different? And so really kind of getting into this practical implementation of things. So this morning, Steve Kochman's method was mentioned. There was kind of two ways we could do multi-step genomic prediction. The one is with the Kochman model, and the other one is with the post-blending, basically. And we've, at Angus, they've run the Kochman model. And I was asked, I think it was Dan asked the question, is who else runs the Kochman model? And I don't think we actually, not sure we came up with an answer of anyone else that does it, but it's been implemented at Angus since 2009, 2010, in that range. And this, I copied the paper. I had to go look it up, BIF Proceedings. It's only a proceedings paper. It was a BIF workshop, and I can remember the presentation, and it's kind of interesting to think that, you know, the work that Steve Kochman put into that, it got implemented, and it's been implemented at Angus for over half a decade now. So, and it served us well. It was basically a way to take, at the time, there were molecular breeding values. This is what people were getting back. And how do you incorporate those into the EPDs using without really changing the genetic evaluation infrastructure? So it was very timely, and it, I think, served the evaluation well. So this two-step process, step one is we go through this genomic calibration phase where we've got animals, we've got EPDs, and we train those SNP effects to the data. And over time, the population to do that has gotten bigger and bigger. And each time we retrain, we call that a calibration. And I wasn't at Angus during some of those calibrations, but my understanding is in the earlier days, as you can see, we've increased the numbers considerably in some of those calibrations, and animals re-rank. And so each time you go through a calibration, there's some re-ranking, dumping a bunch more data in the system, and that's not desirable. So that's going to basically go away now with single step. I'm just a bit challenged because I can't see that screen, but my eyes aren't good enough to read this one either. So I was talking about Steve Kochman's model. This is Steve Kochman's model that he presented at BIF in 2008. The first slide was about the calibration that's done, and Zoetis has implemented that, and you would have saw a lot of the authors on the other paper were people that were associated with Zoetis. But this is the paper from Kochman in 2008. So what does a Kochman model do? Basically, we get these molecular breeding values. So the reason I'm kind of, you want to get into single step, but as we've kind of dove into single step, you see there's differences between single step and what we do now. Well, why are there differences? And we get into it, and we start to understand it better, and we find something typically that we don't like more about multi-step than what we like about single step. So I'm going to walk through the Kochman model in a bit more detail, kind of showing where we run into problems with the Kochman model. So what happens here, this is an example with carcass weight. So if we were to do a genetic evaluation for carcass weight, we'd have one trait. But now we fit this correlated trait, which is the MBV. And on the diagonal here, I've got this, the heritability. So the heritability for carcass weight could be something like 0.38. The heritability of the molecular breeding value is actually really high because it's strictly the SNP effects, and the genotyping accuracy is really high. So the heritability is like close to 1 for the MBV. And then we've got a correlation between the MBV and carcass weight. Here's 0.7. So that's the basis of the Kochman model. That's how that works. But in reality, it's a lot more complicated than that. And this is basically the carcass, part of the carcass model that's run at Angus. So we've got not just carcass weight there, because carcass weight and ribeye area are correlated. You know, bigger carcasses have got bigger ribeyes, and you want to account for that. Bigger cattle at a year of age are typically bigger carcasses. You want to account for that. And we're going to fit ribeye. Well, now we've got ultrasound ribeye traits that need to come in as well. And we've got those on bulls and heifers and steers, all different traits in the model. So this model is getting bigger and bigger. It's not just carcass weight and the MBV anymore. We've got carcass weight, and we've got all the ultrasound scan traits for rib. We've got ultrasound. We've got actual carcass ribeye. But we've also got all the MBVs for carcass weight and ribeye. And to make it a bit more complicated, we've got not just 50K predictions for those traits, but we've got, and Allison, I think, did a really nice job this morning going through the history of MBVs that producers have gotten. And that's happened at Angus. So we've got this database of old predictions, and they're still in the evaluation. Those animals were genotyped. They had an MBV at the time. It had a heritability correlation. So that's all fit. So all those red X's there are all correlations between MBV traits and the traits that we're interested in. And so we need to fit all those extra values in our evaluation. We're actually getting, every time we do a multi-step run, even if an animal's not genotyped, he's getting a breeding value estimate for a step away from the
microphone here. He's getting a breeding value estimate for carcass weight and ribeye area for three different predictions. So there's 6 extra traits potentially to run there,
which adds a lot of overhead to the system. And kind of what we realize as we find differences between is the values that fit in here from these correlations are really important, and it's very sensitive to those. So we need to estimate all those. This is the same set of traits with single step. So it's a lot simpler. We're only evaluating now the traits that we're actually interested in, which creates, you might think, well, that's good for the easier on the computers. It's actually easier on us because we don't have to try and come up with all those correlations to fit in that model. So a single step, we're making it a lot simpler. So now we're actually running a smaller model with less traits. Well, then that actually frees up opportunity now to add some traits because we can make this carcass model. We can include more traits that we hadn't included before. So here I've added some traits. When we look at our carcass model, we had scan weight or weight at a year of age in our model, but we didn't have weaning weight. And why would weaning weight be important? Well, the animals that go on to have a scan weight from weaning are not a random sample. Typically, producers might weigh all their calves at weaning, and the really light ones get culled. So there's a biased sample that goes on. If we don't fit weaning weight at the same time, we don't account for that pre-selection bias. So that's a trait we can now add because we've got a much simpler model with single step. The other thing we can add is we can add fatness in there. There's different maturity patterns that ultrasound fat measurement at a year of age picks up differences in maturity, and we can add that in and fit that in the correlation. So these are actually, it's kind of it gave us an opportunity really to rebuild the carcass trait model because of single step, because single step is simpler, and we can now add those traits. So when I was a grad student, I learned about the animal model and these things from my professor, Larry Schaefer. And Larry wrote a paper here in 2014, you know, is the animal model obsolete? And I thought, well, how could that be true? Because, you know, we've, as like Tom Lawler said this morning about quantitative genetics, you know, that's, it works. It can't be obsolete. But Larry was referring to a phenomenon with genomics. And that is, it was talked about this morning as well, so I think it's really great. I'll just breeze through it. But we don't get a random sample of animals that get genotyped. So in this case, we've got, here's a pile of sons from this bull Xerox, kind of fictitious bull. And they're all genotyped, and then we take the absolute best bulls, and they go on to have daughters in the dairy evaluation. You know, they don't go in our system when we don't account for that all at the same time. So basically with single step, it's better because all the genotypes and all the phenotypes are in the model at the same time. We don't have just the genotyped animals coming up with our prediction equations and then fitting those in a model with all the phenotypes is kind of what happens now. So it's potentially overcomes this source of bias, which is good. I thought Daniela did a good job this morning about differences between different software, and at Angus, we've been working with Georgia for a long time. Or I use the term we. I've been there since September, but you forgive me if I say we a lot. But Angus has been working with Georgia for a long time, and we've been using their, and we're implementing their Georgia software, basically. So although I don't have glasses, that's the team. And I won't dig into single-step GBLUP and because Danielle has covered that. We'll just get into what essentially drives that in the evaluation. So we've got this relationship matrix amongst animals. We've got animals that are just have pedigree. We've got animals that are genotyped. And amongst those genotyped animals, now we can get the relationship between them that's based on the genomic information. And Danielle helped me pull together, you know, what's the range in relationships due to genomics? And just a couple examples. Here's a group of six half-sibs. So you can imagine, you know, we flushed a cow to the same bowl and we got six embryos. And we raised up these calves. And if we didn't know anything about genomics, you'd say the relationship between them should be a half. When I looked at the pedigree, the relationship's actually 0.59. And that's because there's some common sires in the Angus pedigree and adds a little bit of inbreeding, so it's a bit above a half. But when we actually look at their genotypes, all six are genotyped, some are related 0.549 and some are related 0.65. Some of those flush mates are more related to each other than others, and that's essentially what's driving the genomic prediction in single step. The other example is a bunch of half-sibs, so we'd expect these 232 half-sibs from the same sire to have a relationship amongst each other of a quarter. It's 0.29. It's a bit more than that due to inbreeding. But the most unrelated of those animals is only 0.19. So there's actually, it's not quite half the relationship, but it's getting close. So there's a lot more variation in relationships that we can account for with genomics, and that's what's driving single step. So what's the benefit for us? Every week, all the genomic information we have, all the phenotype, all the pedigree goes into that evaluation. So unlike now, where we're running on a calibration that was implemented of April last year, so it's basically just a year old, so that's not that long, but we've done a lot of genotyping in that time. So all those genotypes, if we recalibrate today, which essentially is what's going to happen on the 7th of July, it's going to be a, you know, one big recalibration, because now we're going to have over 300,000 animals in the evaluation with genotypes, not 100,000. That's dumping a lot more information in. But that information now is going to trickle in every week. So every week as we genotype animals, they get added, and the numbers are going to, I would say, creep instead of jump with big calibrations. So we won't do calibrations anymore and potentially reduce some bias. Just a little bit about what's happening around the world. I guess it was covered this morning as well, but we talked about UGA software and Bolt this morning. There are a couple other softwares out there. One is Mix99, it's out of Finland. And if you were in Europe and talking to European companies and cattle associations and things, some of them are running with Mix99 software. AgBoo does the evaluations. I don't know if Dave Johnson's in the room or not. There he is. Yeah, so we were visiting the other night. They've implemented single step now for the Brahmin evaluations, so that's gone live after visiting with David, and that's software written right there at AgBoo. So there is a range of software out there that people are using, and as it was mentioned this morning, pigs and poultry, dairy cattle, beef. There's a big movement, really, to single step. For a lot of the reasons that we're talking about. So just to give you some idea of the size, and this is one of the, you know, single step, I think, as Daniela pointed out this morning, first kind of was invented, you could say, in 2009, I think. But here we are in 2017 getting it implemented, and why is that? Well, the work had to go into actually getting it to run with big data sets. And I think in terms of Angus, it is a big data set. There's the growth evaluation here with weaning weights, over 8 million animals, and 337,000 genotypes. So while we're, as Mark, I think, didn't really anticipate that I was going to pick you out for this, but major change, which it is a major change. While we're making a major change, you might as well change a lot of things. And the one thing that hadn't been done in a while is re-estimating all the parameters that go into our evaluation. So the heritabilities and genetic correlations that are behind the Angus evaluation, we've re-estimated all of those. So when people see a new set of numbers on the 7th of July, they're going to think single step, but really it's single step, new parameters, and actually some new models, things that weren't fit before. We've actually made some things better. So this is just gives you a rundown, old heritabilities, new heritabilities. For the most part, our heritabilities up a little bit. A lot of them are pretty much the same, but our new estimates are slightly higher in some cases. Pick out, dry matter intake, 36 versus 31. You know, not huge differences, but there are some. Are some differences that we've identified. So that's just the heritabilities, but then we've got the correlations amongst all the traits, and they've been re-estimated as well. I wanted to have a slide about run times, how long does it take to run it. There's actually been a lot of work here in the last month gone into tuning up the run time. So our calving ease evaluation that was at something like 56 hours with single step, I think we're down to just about a day, I think, now. So That's good news, because what we'd like to do at the moment, our data cutoff's the end of the day on Tuesday, and then we turn evaluations out on Friday. And if something goes wrong, we could actually rerun it. And we'd like that option if, you know, who knows what. Stuff does happen now and then. That you could actually rerun the whole thing and not miss that cutoff. So that's something that we're working for. The reason I don't have a slide is because our IS people pointed out that it would be unfair comparison, because they're not actually running multi-step today on the same hardware that they're running single step. We've got new hardware, new servers, new operating system and everything to run single step. So we talk a lot about the genotypes, and we did a slide the other day, but there's over... So the samples come into Angus, and then they go out to the various labs, and the samples are all logged there in a vault. And there's 909,000 samples in the vault now. And sometime this year, we'll hit 1 million samples. And I'm kind of promoting internally at Angus, we should have some kind of mysterious prize for the millionth sample that comes in. But there's over 300,000 genotypes. You think that's a lot, which it is. But if you think about the big evaluation, it's still a small proportion. I put this pie graph up to draw the point. You know, that the little wedge there is actually the number of genotyped animals in our growth evaluation. The rest of the pie is actually all the ungenotyped animals. So, you know, we focus a lot on genomics, but still it's overwhelmed in the evaluation by non-genotyped animals at the moment. I put this slide together last fall, and in reality, the people at Angus are getting tired because they've been riding those two horses since November. So single step and the multi-step has been running side by side during that time, which lets us look at a lot of things like stability and speed. And then as we change the model, we have another look at things. And on my very first slide, I guess I should acknowledge, Dan and Kelly are both in the room here. Certainly it's not all me, but besides us, there's people in terms of the IT side that do a lot of programming and a lot of crunching numbers and keeping track of files and all these different runs and different models and comparing them and putting all that together for us. So it's certainly not a three-man band, that's for sure. So what do our new numbers look like compared to our old numbers? And this is where the major part comes in, that these numbers aren't, we're not giving you something that's 0.99 correlated. And we're having a discussion with somebody once, and they, you know, what's all the fuss about? You know, it's pretty minuscule change, really. No, it's not going to be minuscule. You know, breeders are going to notice. It's these correlations, a lot of them are, we start with that left-hand column there, 0.99 in a lot of cases. Those are highly accurate. Those are more accurate bulls. Those are the top 200 sires, we call them. You know, they got a lot of their own progeny data. You can throw genomics in or out of those, and it shouldn't change too much. It's the younger sires where we're going to see the differences. The genomics has a bigger impact on those animals. And there we've got, for example, milk is always a problem trait in beef cattle, but 76. Correlation, calving ease, 85. Heifer pregnancy, categorical trait. Also a trait we don't have nearly as much data on. You know, growth, we got lots of data on growth. And I think Matt Spangler made a great point this morning about phenotypes, right? And Daniela emphasized it nicely with her credit card and her cash. You know, you can use your credit card for a while without the cash, but it doesn't last very long. It all comes down to phenotypes. So things like heifer pregnancy, fertility, traits, we need to get more phenotypes on. On the carcass side of things, you know, marbling here, 0.85, ribeye, 0.8, carcass weight, 0.67 on young bulls. So those are going to be some significant changes. So that's kind of the magnitude of the change. So as you're sitting there and you get this new set of numbers and things are not correlated 0.99, and you say, well, they're different. And what's the saying, you know, different, better is always different, but different's not always better. So now we see that they're different, but are they better? Is what we need to determine. And I don't know if Doug Frank's in the audience or not, but I told him earlier today, he might not remember, but I remember he came in my office after I first started, and he's just in passing at the end of the conversation, says, Steve, have you ever noticed that there's some bulls that they got a lot of progeny and they still move for like yearling weight and they've got like a lot of progeny? Why is that? So those things kind of stick in the back of your mind. And so this is a bull, 878 from ABS. And this is what his yearling weight EPD looks like from the first published sire summary. So I actually have an intern and I actually had her go. She had sire summaries piled up because we didn't have it electronically. So she looked them all up here late last week. And this is the numbers that were printed on that bull over time. What I can say, and this is, if you ever work at a breed association, you'll realize this is true, that in the early days,
his yearling weight actually went up more than the possible change table said it should. But don't be called. then it started coming down, and of course that's when the phone starts to ring.
The term in the industry that people are applying to this phenomenon, it's not just 878, there's a pile of bulls like this, yearling weight drift, right? Why their yearling weights drifting down on these bulls? That's way beyond the possible change table. for any ball, because he's, I think, look up his accuracies, he's 95, 99, 98, right across the board there. So we did this exercise of looking through all the old Sire summaries, and there's a few things that start to come to light. And at the same time, we're getting our single-step evaluations for carcass weight. And the standard deviation of our carcass weight EPDs is less than, significantly less than, what we get with our typical production run. So that gives you less spread in your EPDs. So what's right? So we said, well, what was our EPD standard deviation before we ever did anything with genomics? So we dug up the old Sire summaries and looked that up. And what we see over time is our standard deviation of carcass weight, it's the another analogy, but you know, how do you boil a frog? If you throw him in hot water, he jumps out, but you turn up the heat a little more, and he doesn't realize it's happening. And that's essentially each of these lines here is another Sire summary. So over time, the standard deviation is not actually increasing that much from the time before, but it's cumulatively increasing. So if we do evaluation without genomics, we get basically, if this goes back,
this is spring of 05, and this is when genomics kicks in here, somewhere around the spring of 10. So you know, we start with genomics, and then every calibration, we start dumping in a lot more genotypes, a little density genotyping, and our standard deviation is going up. Why?
Why is that? I'm going to jump back to this crazy matrix again with all these red X's in it.
What we realize is these red X's with correlations between our molecular breeding values and the traits, if I start changing those correlations, I can start to change the trend line for Angus, basically.
So it's very sensitive to that. One more slide. So here's our genetic trend for marbling in what we call a classic run. So throw out all the genomics and let's just run a good old blop without genomics. Pedigree, performance, that's it. And here's your genetic trend for marbling. Then I'm going to lay on top here what our genetic trend is for single step. And you might not have noticed a difference because the two lines are almost identical. The single step trend lays on top of that non-genomic trend almost perfectly. And it does it for almost all the traits. There's some differences, but for the most part, that's how it behaves. What's happening with each of those calibrations, the standard deviation of carcass weight's going up, but our genetic trend was also accelerating. So what's happening with those older bulls is each calibration, the trend goes up a little bit, while the recent bulls go up and the older bulls go down in each calibration, and that's how those bulls drifted. So it's kind of a roundabout story, I guess, that you know what's causing the trend. It's actually an artifact of what are the genetic correlations we fit between all these MBVs and the traits in that big model. Although you estimate them, it's obviously sensitive to that. And with single step, that trend inflation problem basically goes away. So that was what was contributing to the drift. I had one more. Had one more slide in there about drift, but gone on me. I'll come back to it if it doesn't show up again. We had a PowerPoint thing at the beginning here, so that was one set. So that's like one set of evidence. You know, here's something peculiar in our evaluation. Doesn't make sense. Single step has fixed that problem. Not just 878, but I did an analysis across 12 bulls, and on average, those 12 bulls were losing 2 pounds a year from 2011 to 2017, and with single step, they lose 0.3 pounds a year, which is within expected change. So basically, the answer was single step fixes this drift problem. The next thing we did was Larry Keen took our different, because I said, well, what should the trend be? You know, is single step right? Is classic right? Is multi-step right? So through that process, Larry ran a correlation between our EPDs and what they get at USDA Mark. In their, they have 196 Angus sires that have got progeny there, and that's basically an independent data set. So that their data doesn't flow back into our evaluation, so we're not kind of like double counting or anything like that. And so we run the correlation between what we do today in multi-step and what we're going to go to in terms of single step. And what we see here is, in almost all the cases except for ribeye, multi-step and single-step have got the same correlation, or single-step is better. And sometimes, for example, the 0.61, it's rounding. It might have been, I think it's 0.605 and 0.614 or something. But single-step, even if, if you want to get into more decimals, single-step is a little bit better. Carcass weight, 37 correlation versus 34. Some traits, we see a bigger jump than others. So fat, for example, with single step, we're at 41 versus 25 with multi-step. So I think that for us was kind of the light bulb goes on that single step is doing a better job than what we're doing today. So that's with USDA Mark data. But what about our own data? So we actually took our data and we said, okay, when do we do our, we did our calibration, our last calibration, when do we pull the data for that? Let's do a single-step run up to that point and a multi-step run at that point. And then we're going to take phenotypes that have come in since then. There's about 120,000 animals, I think, with phenotypes I use in the evaluation. And let's look to see how single-step genomic predictions or the multi-step genomic predictions relate to the actual phenotypes that have come in. And the metric I'm using here is what the R-square of the model was. And what we see is single-step is always basically better than multi-step with our own data. This is for the growth traits. So that's good news. The other thing we want to look at is basically inflation, or are we over-predicting? And we expect this number to be close to 2, and it is pretty close to 2. So we've got, there's, the method's not perfect to begin with, so I think we're pretty happy with where that landed. We pulled out just the genomic values, direct genomic values, for multi-step and single-step. And again, the direct genomic values. Daniela wants to call them Daniela genomic values for DGVs. But the DGVs come from single-step and the MBVs come from multi-step. And again, the DGVs are doing slightly better or the same as the MBVs. So that's actually, I think, an important thing to realize as well. You looked at these improvements, sometimes the correlations are the same, and sometimes single step is slightly better. They're not hugely better. You know, we're not going from 0.2 to 0.8. We're not going to see a land shift in accuracy. We're seeing some improvement in accuracy, which is good, but we're also seeing it fix things like this yearling weight drift. So there's my drift slide. It's slightly out of order, but so those 12 bulls, on average, they change 13 pounds with the drift. And with single step, they only drift 2 pounds, which they could drift up to 3 pounds and still be within putting distance for statistical accuracy. So, okay, what about our accuracies? Our accuracies are higher, basically higher for single step. You know, what's behind that? Well, we've got a lot more data in there. We know it is doing a better job at forward predicting, so we expect the numbers to go up a bit. And that's what we're seeing with our accuracies. We've taken our accuracies for all the different traits, and we've put it into progeny equivalence. That's the kind of the table that we've shown for the last number of years. You know, what does the genomic value mean in terms of progeny equivalence? The old way and the new way, there's a few, for the most part, it's pretty similar. There are some changes. Milk, for example, is one that's... there's a couple of contributing factors. The heritability for milk went down, so that gives you more progeny equivalence just because the equation. But for the most part, we're in the same ballpark in terms of progeny equivalence, slightly more accuracy with single step than multi-step. Okay. I put this slide together, and I think everybody's guilty, probably lots of people in the room, even if they aren't involved with Angus. There's been a lot of hype about single step. Right, I showed you the correlations, a bit better, not a lot better, fixes a few things, it's simpler, I think it is the way to go, but we've built up in the minds of the breeders that they've been driving the 37 Chev, and we've been hiding the 2017 Chev in the garage, and we haven't let them at it, right? I think we've gone maybe from a 2007 Chev to a 2017 Chev, not a 37, but this is their perception. So I think we need to be careful in the future about talking about things too far ahead of time. It's good to get people excited and let you know what they're working on, but if we have too much hype over too long a period, I think we inflate expectations a little bit. So the re-ranking and movement of animals come the 7th of July won't be minuscule. Mark said major. I think in terms of, let's face it, people talk about they're really worried calibration to calibration. Well, exact same method, exact same software, just a bit more data. Now we're dealing with a lot more data, totally different software, different method, different models, different parameters. There's a lot more. If you thought the calibration to calibration was a big change, this is a major change because there's a lot more things changing in the program. Phenotypes and genotypes required was stated again this morning a few times, and just to point out that is on the radar. Carcass, for example, if you noticed on our list of traits there, we've got almost 2 million ultrasound records, but only 100-something thousand carcass records. You know, carcass obviously drives revenue in terms of all our economic models. We need good carcass evaluations. We need more carcass data. So there's a program underway to get those data. And this spring, for example, 3,000 cows bred to high-use bulls that don't have carcass yet, that don't have a lot of carcass data. So the idea is, here's high-use bulls; they're going to have a lot of progeny. We want a good carcass evaluation on those, and basically build that data set. So these are again what's coming on the 7th of July. Again, new methods, new parameters. Kind of rebuilt the carcass model, incorporating things like that pre-selection at weaning, difference in maturity pattern, which I think is an improvement. Incorporating birth without weaning, that's a technical thing for Angus, but in the past they didn't process birth weights until the weaning weights came in. Now we can actually take the birth weights as they come online, so that's really important for young sires. So someone can actually see their carcass EPD based on their first crop of calves before they breed heifers to them again. That's pretty important. And we're also going to talk about economics today, but updated economic assumptions. Been working with Cattle Facts in terms of economic projections on economic assumptions for the dollar values as well. So it's going to be 7-7. Hopefully it's a lucky number. Questions?
The reason, there's a couple things with correlations is the bull's accuracy is based on the number of progeny. They're not 90. If they were 99% accurate, you'd expect it to be related to the actual accuracy of the prediction. But since you got bulls in there that could have a 60% accuracy for some traits, that's why it's lower.
I'm still trying to get my mind around the drift.
Yeah.
Genomic fact is that is a limit.
Thanks. I think they're catching the audio on that. So the question was, why aren't we going to see drift basically with single step, but we see it with multi-step, but we've kind of got the same similar prediction accuracy with both? And my after looking at it, what I think is going on, it's to do with those correlations that we fit between. So it's to do with the method. So right now we've got this multi-trait model where we're fitting the MBVs, and then we got the correlation with the trait, and we got the heritability of the MBV. And we've got all those. We don't just got an MBV in terms of 50K, but we've got these historic predictions as well. And all those red X's create all this very complex matrix over there. A bunch of them are zero. A bunch of them are correlated. And if we don't have those just right, it's causing that inflation in the trend that we don't see that with single step. We just don't see that. Because we actually went back to 2015 and ran the two, and then ran it in 2017, and you get the drift with the multi-step, but you just don't get it with a single step. So I think it's actually, although the prediction's the same, it's the method that's different.
So the single step versus the previous method is the influence
of
genomics decrease as the individual becomes more accurate
for training,
like it did.
Yeah, there was actually a slide we had a slide, cows that had from one progeny up to 20, and then their accuracy, whether genotyped or not. And yeah, you get that nice distribution where we actually get a bigger lift for a cow with just one progeny, because we're getting a bit better. We've got a lot more data going in now for weaning weight, say. But then as you add more and more progeny, she goes up a bit, but not, and then an animal that's not genotyped, well, as you add more and more progeny, she goes up quite a bit more. But there's still a benefit to genotyping, even with an animal with 10 progeny for weaning weight, for example. So we did have another slide, but I didn't include that one. But the pattern is similar to what you're used to seeing. Yeah, our convergence criteria hasn't changed. So like that multi-step model runs to something the minus 12 or whatever it is, or 13. I don't know.
If the older bulls were drifting down, does that mean that some of the younger sires would maybe be an overshot? Or
yeah. So what's, if you think about that, yeah, so there's two sides to that trend line, right? You've got, the question was, if the older bulls are drifting down, are the younger bulls that were too high? And the answer is yes. So, you know, if we take that trend line and we said it's too steep right now and we fix it and we drop it like this, well, those older bulls, yeah, come up, but the younger bulls are going to come down. Doug? Yeah, so I averaged him out. I had him with, I should have actually shown what his was, but all of those bulls on average they came down 13 pounds, and now on average they come down 2 pounds. So I could have looked, I don't want to be confident to say, yeah, he is now, I should have went back and looked him up, but I think you'll find now he wouldn't have come down more than 2 pounds, basically. So if he was at 80 and drifted down. I think he's 60. I saw him in the catalog last night. He's 69, I think. So he's going to be 11 more than that. He's going to be up close to 80 again. Mr. Good. Yeah.
Significantly. What other trades did y'all have, or were y'all able to do, or did y'all change the models on other trades for, you know, wind weight, early weight, any other trades besides carcass?
So that birth without weaning change includes correlations now between birth and growth traits that weren't there before. So if you've got, for people that are measuring both birth weight and weaning weight, you won't see big changes, but for guys that aren't taking birth weights but are taking weaning weights, bulls with big weaning weights are going to drag up their birth weight EPD if they don't have a real birth weight to put them where they should be. So that's one change. The other change is, I think we didn't change the model, but some of the parameters behind dry matter intake have changed slightly, and that'll cause some differences. And then the carcass trait, because we've added that weaning and fat into the carcass model. That's those are the big changes. We actually, you know, I had to actually go like this to the IS people. I swear, I said, we're not going to change any more models between the 7th of July. So, but there's some more improvements to make though. So, you know. And I think single step just opens up the opportunity to do that, because before, with all those MBV traits, it's very complicated. But now we pull all them out, we can start to add traits in and make it more multi-trait, which is better. So, yes, Lauren. It's different. Daniel will have to answer that, but it's a different set of accuracy programs that run with single step versus what we do now. Yeah. Yes, sir. Page dependent? Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, no, there's going to be re-ranking.
None of those that are going down are mine, are they?
Had a,
the older bulls are going up.
Had a guy call me the other day. He was going to go to a sale and buy a heifer, and it was going to be a real high-dollar heifer. He's going to spend a lot of money on her, and he wants to know where she's going to land with a single step, because he doesn't want to spend all this money and find out she goes down. I said, you should go buy 5 heifers, and on average, they won't change as much. I didn't take the bait on that one. Actually, with the 878, it's probably the first time we've ever shown anybody any numbers on any bulls.
Are the weight or the movement between accuracies, was that, you know, we've got the old one that we've been working off the old model that, you know, beats 0.3, you can move, what, 10 pounds one way or the other. Is that changed in the single step? Will that be modified?
Yeah, we will have to change that, because the standard deviation of the standard deviation of the EPDs will be slightly different, and so that change table will have to be changed. Yeah. That'll be a tweak. Thank you.
Any other questions for Steve? Now let's thank him.
Okay.